It is that time again for another episode of Stick a Fork in It.
In person, the special kind.
I know, right? And soon it's going to be in person all the time because go ahead and share your excitement.
We're going to have our very own dedicated recording studio. We'll have space for guests to come and sit in comfort and chat with us in person. It's way easier than Zoom. Sounds better.
Yes.
Just, it's better.
And eventually video too, so you can watch us.
Yeah.
If you want.
Very exciting.
Which is pretty exciting, too. So you and I today went to an amazing event.
Mm-hmm.
We partner with the Workforce Development Group.
Mm-hmm.
And share a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's very cool. It gives high school students an opportunity to, like, go to job fairs, intermingle with, you know, professionals, see what kind of stuff they like to do. There's all kinds of possibilities there. You know, you can, you know, get, like, these, like, paid periods of, like, trial periods at jobs.
Yeah.
It's really cool. You know, it kind of gives you an opportunity to see what your future could feel like, you know, working in different jobs.
And that's so exciting to me because there's so many kids that are in high school mm-hmm. or even college that, you know, don't know what's going to happen, don't know what their path might be. And to have all that encouragement, all the folks cheering for them is really special and it launches them into a great place. And why I bring that up is our guest today. Because part of his story, many might not know, is he can tell us about when he was a student and we can see just where he came to in his life to this day. So every once in a while, he's going to come on to the podcast from now on and take over with some friends. Welcome back, Mr. Thomas Mance.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I am so sorry you were not able to attend one of those sessions because I think you would be so incredibly moved. For me, that is when you take a student and you believe in them and what the possibilities are, you know. Generational poverty can actually be changed when people are surrounding them and making life better.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going into that because tell us about your story. We're going to talk a lot about you, a little bit of personal stuff that lends into you as a professional. What was high school and what was student life for you?
So I think, let me start with what you opened with. I think that the assumption that there are traditional pathways for people, and that they'll follow those traditional pathways is one that we have to think differently about. I think what Future Career Academy is doing is thinking very differently about it, making sure that someone does have a pathway. I think given what pressure exists on schools already today,
mm-hmm.
You know, at my age, we had guidance counselors, but they had two for the entire school. Mm-hmm. I think our class graduated 500 or 600 people. So their ability to have a conversation with you or guide you thoughtfully through a process was difficult. And their focus probably was much more on the folks that were going to college.
Right.
That those were helping, they were helping those folks that were filling out applications, trying to figure out a way to go to college. It didn't really occur to me to go to college. It wasn't something that I would have thought I would do.
Mm-hmm.
I did not graduate high school with any sort of honors. In fact, probably I was more on the other end of the class. I was not a good student. I didn't enjoy the process. Largely, I felt ill-equipped to be a part of that process thoughtfully. While I was a significant reader and took in a lot of information, school subjects had very little interest to me. It took me a long time later in life to understand that if you don't have an aptitude for school subjects, it doesn't mean you're not a capable learner.
Right.
So, but coming out of that process, I felt that that I was just not in the same position as a lot of my peers. I didn't feel like I had the same skills or abilities. I didn't think that I would qualify for college. I probably would not have if you look at things like GPA, and I think I took the SATs, but at this point I do not remember.
Mm-hmm.
But it just wasn't a pathway that I saw myself going down. And a corollary question to that is people often ask me, you know, what did you want to be when you grew up? That never once occurred to me. It never once occurred to me to say, outside of being an athlete, right? When you're an athlete, you think, oh, could I play professionally? And you learn pretty soon that that's not, the odds are a bit stacked against you.
For some.
Yeah.
For 99.9%
of you, yeah.
Of
exactly.
Anybody that's ever kicked a ball or shot a basket or whatever it is, they don't turn professional.
Right.
So, but it never occurred to me to say, what do I want to do with my life? I simply went and found the job that would pay me money.
Right.
I'd worked all through high school. That was something my parents wanted and required. And so so I think ending the answer finally, what Future Career Academy is doing is what's absolutely important and necessary in our communities, where they're helping people figure out there is a future for you. Because there's an awful lot of folks that don't feel like there's a future for them. They feel like there might be a job awaiting them, but they don't feel like there's a career or a future awaiting them.
Well, and it may be the experience they have up until that point, right? So when I was a kid, it was college wasn't made a priority in my home either. But to see our community surrounding kids throughout Hillsborough County and believing in them and taking a whole year to train them for the possibility of being self-sufficient out of high school, I just think is a beautiful thing, and it's inspiring.
It is. And I think, you know, I don't want this to sound like college as a pathway is not a good one. It's a fantastic one. If my life had been differently, I would lament or would have wanted the opportunity to go to a four-year college and enjoy that experience and dive into that. As it was, I went to college at night. And so I had an interest in getting a degree, but it was a much longer pathway for me to do that.
So we're talking about all these mentors for these kids. Let's turn into like your life a little bit. Did you have mentors or influencers that did have shift your path? Is there someone that stands out?
I've been thinking a lot about, folks have been asking me with some frequency, what do I think about the new building and what do I think about our success? And I'm sure that may be a topic for today's conversation. Mm-hmm. What I find myself reflecting on most is the journey and the people who have been a part of the journey. The building is a thing. It's an important thing. But I've been thinking back to how do you get here? I was having a conversation with one of our colleagues yesterday about some of the people that we want to make sure we invite to the grand opening that were here 11 or 12 years ago when I walked in the doors. But because I don't think anybody does anything in life without someone stepping into their world. There's a wonderful parable I heard many, many years ago that a gentleman shared, and it goes like this. Two men are talking in a bar in Alaska. One is a man of great faith and believes very much in fate and faith. The other man is a non-believer. And so the man of faith is explaining to him why faith is important to him, and the non-believer finally says, look, I tried that whole faith thing. I tried that whole God thing, and it just didn't work. And the man of faith says, well, tell me about that. And the gentleman shares, well, there was one day where I was lost in a snowstorm, and I had no way out. My transportation was broken, and I was going to die. And the man of faith looks at him and says, well, you're here. You must believe. Another gentleman said, no, some damn Eskimo came by in a motorcycle or in a snowmobile, picked me up and took me back in. And I've often contemplated the idea of Eskimos because I've had a lot of them in my life that at certain points they have guided me, cared for me, picked me up, helped me onto the back of their snowmobile and helped me find a way towards another place. One of the first ones, I would not have ever called it a mentor, but there was a gentleman named Tom Hudson who lived next to our house when I was a teenager, at which point my life was in a significant degree of chaos, and I was as lost as a human being as you could be. I would go next door to Tom, and he often was outside working on his car. He was that kind of guy, and I would just talk to Tom. And Tom was probably between my age and my dad's age, about middle split. Right. So he understood my father's responsibilities, that he had kids. Mm-hmm. He also understood the challenges I was having as a young teenager. And Tom would just listen to me and talk to me, and he would offer me perspective. I would share with him my frustrations or my concerns, my fears. Mm-hmm. And he would, in a very calm and thoughtful way, importantly for me, non-judgmentally, he would allow me the opportunity just to make my way through some of the things I was struggling with. Years later, when I entered into the workspace, there was a gentleman named Michael Gilson in it, and Michael was probably 4 or 5 years older than me, and I met him at work, and Michael stepped into much the same role. Michael's the guy that taught me how to balance a checkbook. So think about that. I finally get my first job. I set up a bank, paycheck, weekly paycheck job, and I have my own apartment. I have no idea how to pay bills. I don't know how you do it.
Wow.
Right. So Michael sits down. He said, okay, you take all of your, here's how you take your bills. You put them in date order that they have to be paid. Right. You know, right. But Michael was a mentor in many, many different ways. He would listen to me again as I was navigating being a person in a huge corporate environment that I was unfamiliar with, something we do in our job training program very thoughtfully to make sure people have those kinds of resources around them. Michael was that for me. Probably 6 or 7 years into my career, I got my first big promotion into management. Big deal.
And where were you? What career?
I was working in the banking finance world, but I was working for a finance arm of AT&T, which at the time was the largest employer in the United States. So I got my first big promotion. It was a big deal. Being management was a thing. It's a little different than today's environment where there are different structures and boundaries. But then when I started my job, my boss was a fellow named George Menendez. And once again, someone stepped into my life and George took me under his wing and he coached me on how to manage other people. George was the kind of guy that would, I don't think he had an interest in mentoring me. I don't think that's ever anything that he set out to do, but he explained everything he did. And so I was just like a sponge. You know, I remember one time, a simple example, but it's just that kind of humanity. He said, if someone has to hear bad news, tell them Friday afternoon so they can go home with their family and spend the weekend and get used to it before they have to come back on Monday. Give them a chance to just deal with that.
Process.
And George had, if he had one of those, he had 100 of those. And again, one more time, he took me under his wing. A coda to that story was, I ended up having significant success in the corporate world. And when I left that world to come into this one, I went back and I found George and I took him to lunch and I said, thank you. And he said, for what? And I shared with him, you know, the importance of his role in my life. The last one that I'll share is when I came to Tampa, as you know, may come out in today's story, or certainly folks know, the food bank was a bit of a fixer-upper. We had a fair amount of challenges and issues. And the pressure was significant. The business had great risks as to whether it would stay open. And a friend I had met introduced me to a guy named Jeff Derry. And Jeff, as listeners will know, founded Trinity Cafe. But long before we ever contemplated working together, Jeff became yet another mentor. He was someone that I could ask questions of, run things by, create perspective. Give me the opportunity to say, hey, this is what I'm thinking about or what I'm considering. So all along, intentional or otherwise, people come into your world. Those are four that I would think about. But there have been myriad people across my pathway that have given me just one more piece of information or one more word of encouragement or one more suggestion or an opportunity to learn something. One of the things I suggest, I guest lectured a couple of classes at USF and UT. One of the things that I suggest to all younger folks is you have to remain a lifelong learner. The moment you stop that, you're basically saying, I want to end my effective capability because I'm going to stop with what I know today. And so there are countless Eskimos that have come across my path that have helped me understand something in a different way than I did before, have enlightened me in some sort of fashion. But I think all of us need people to help guide us. I think that's why we work so hard against the idea that there is a bootstraps moment or personality. Because as we would know with equity, not everybody has the same opportunities and not everybody, even though they may possess the personal wherewithal to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, if they do not have the resources around them, their circumstances are impossible to get there. So I've been very fortunate. I am the product of people that were willing to say, I see something in you. When I interviewed for the job at AT&T, it was a very big deal. I had no college degree. I barely got out of high school. I was 19 or 20 years old. And I went through the interview process and I got hired. And it was a big deal. Benefits, steady job, national company. I was going to be at the very bottom, which I was fine with. I just wanted in the door. 3 years later, I ended up working for the person that hired me. She was in HR at that point. She had moved over to management. We had a conversation one day and she said, I wasn't going to hire you. And I said, really? She goes, there was just too much in your background that was, she didn't use the word sketchy, but that just was.
I felt like that's where you were going, sketchy.
She said, but I decided to take a chance.
Right.
I thought I just saw something. Right. And so when you realize that moment happens, that those things happen in a way that you're not aware of, that's when you realize that, you know, I'll finish with this again, another statement that's important to my own personal philosophy. Change happens where grace and effort meet. Right. I worked hard, but there's been a whole lot of grace along the way.
Mm-hmm. Surely. Absolutely. How did you end up in Tampa interviewing for the position here with all of that history? And I know you got to travel the world in the banking industry. And how did you end up here?
So I think going back to the question you asked, what did you want to, you didn't ask, but I answered, what did you want to do with your life, right?
Right.
I'll just ask and answer my own question.
There you go.
So most interviews work, right?
We'll just
much easier.
Back.
We'll just.
Yeah, just go. Go with it.
As I made my way into the career that I started with AT&T and then subsequently with the couple of large corporations, I realized that I had a talented facility for what I was doing. And I knew that A, because of success, and B, because of compensation and the way they, right? So I moved up pretty quickly through the ranks of the corporate world and was recruited pretty heavily to do a wide variety of tasks. And the more I was recruited, the more I was paid, the more I was given responsibility, the less I felt like I was drawn to it or that it was me. When I realized I wasn't scrambling for my life anymore, because I lived a lot of my young adult life unable to pay my bills. Michael, the guy I talked about a little while ago, Michael helped me work out a schedule where I would pay a different bill late every month. Right. So I'd pay the electric bill late one month. I'd pay the rent late. And he made me call. I shouldn't say he made me. You got to call him.
Yep.
And you have to say, you know, Mr. Electric Company, I'm going to be late this month. Can you, right? And it's amazing the grace people showed.
I was going
to
say, you were
that.
Living through grace in that time.
Right.
But I've had to do that in my past life.
And so,
too.
You know, I lived paycheck to paycheck for the first probably 7 or 8 years of my career, right? You know, just trying to, I remember going to Publix, don't publish this. I would go to Publix on Wednesday night and I would kite my check because the money would hit. Right? It would hit my bank account on Thursday, but I could go to Publix after 6 p.m. on Wednesday and cash my check.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And so, right, it's just things like that. I mean, a big change for me was when they went from $5 to $10 out of the ATM. Hmm. Right? That hurt because I couldn't take five.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
I was
yes.
living margin to margin, counting change.
Mm. Right.
But at a certain point, I had enough success and I started to put some resources behind me and was able to start to say, well, okay, if I had perspective, what would I do? Mm-hmm. If I had the opportunity to more manage my own world, would I make some different decisions? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that was unequivocally yes. While the corporate world was very good to me, there are many people that are incredibly successful in it and enjoy it immensely, it was not something I felt drawn to. I enjoyed many aspects of what I did. I built a lot of teams. I ran large-scale organizations. I appreciated that. Mm-hmm. Those skills paid off handsomely in the work I do today. But it wasn't an environment I cared about. And what I found was I needed to care about what I was doing. When I worked in the corporate world, I cared about the people I was working with, but I didn't have the same passion for or dedication to that craft. I was talking to a guy this morning that is a financial planner, and his interest in and obsession with his subject is fascinating. I mean, he loves every single aspect of that, right?
Right.
He lives and breathes it. He can tell you rule, regulation, why this matters, why that matters. And it is so refreshing to have someone that is that dedicated to their craft. It doesn't matter whether you're on the for-profit or nonprofit side. What you want is passion and dedication to your craft. And I just didn't find that environment in the place that I lived. So I was in a place where I could, but more importantly, in a place where I did, cash all my chips in. I walked into my boss's office and said, I'm leaving in 30 days. Here's what I think I need to finish before I go. I was living in New York City at the time. and I'm going to just not do this anymore, which he thought was insane.
Yeah, I was going to say, what was his reaction to that? Was it right. like shock and awe?
Well,
like,
people don't
what?
Walk away from that kind of money.
No.
I was leaving stock options and other, right? I was walking away from money that I would earn and that I had earned, because in most of those situations, you have golden handcuffs to keep you there. I walked away from all of that. And I don't want this to sound like, hey, I'm the best guy in the world. I would say that it was worth it to me.
Right.
That's the difference. I didn't have enough money to retire, but I had enough money to manage the change.
Okay.
And so made my way to Florida, where I had lived previously, because it's a non-income tax state. I had a piece of property here, easier place to land, sold my apartment in New York City to my eternal regret, made my way here and made my way into the nonprofit world. And I spent a bunch of time helping different nonprofits grow their capacity and capability. One day I got a call from a person I'd worked with in the food banking world, because I was at the food bank in Jacksonville. And she said, hey, you did a great job there in Jacksonville. Tampa is interested in your capability. Would you be willing to talk to them? And I thought, you know, sure. And so they called, and I drove over here. I did a fair amount of research, but I drove over here to Tampa. Funny story and timing. I did a tour yesterday at a new facility with the board chair that hired me and my predecessor, Pat. They were the ones that made the decision, particularly the board chair at the time made the decision to hire me. Mm-hmm. But I came over and I had a conversation with them. And what was important to me about coming here was two things. One is in my entire career, at that point, 30 years, I had never worked one job more than 3 years. Right? Not that I changed companies, but I was always being moved around.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I was doing the moving.
Right.
Yes. But I, you know, I would take on a task or responsibility and I would finish that and I would move on to another position. I was interested in staying. I was interested in the idea of building something and seeing it through. And so Tampa had two great opportunities for someone like me. One was, it was a fixer-upper, and I'm attracted to that. I would not want to go in and succeed someone who's enormously successful, just not the way I'm built.
Right.
I'd far rather have a challenge. The second thing that it had was the opportunity to have longevity, that I could spend the rest of my career doing this work in this place. And so we had a couple of great conversations. I interviewed with a bunch of folks, got my car and drove home, not knowing whether they would go forward or not. But I felt like, boy, if y'all don't hire me, I'm not sure what you're thinking.
How long did it take for you to get the call?
Not long.
Not long.
Not long. And, you know, my wife and I, the last kid had left. My wife and I, you know, packed everything in the, you know, car and came down. Not lived in Tampa before and moved to this great community. It was still 10 years later, 11, almost 12 years later. It's a very different community, but came here and settled in and settled into the task. And so, yeah, I think probably between the we probably had a conversation in mid-September, and by October I was here.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you walked in to Feeding Tampa Bay, or what was it called when you first got here 11 years ago?
Feeding America Tampa Bay, which
Feeding
it had
America.
Been for a couple of years. Prior to that, it was Second Harvest of Tampa Bay, and prior to that, it was Divine Providence Food Bank.
Oh, wow.
So talk about an identity crisis.
Yes, yes.
It's a few different identities going on,
It's a mouthful. Feeding America Tampa Bay is a lot.
It had branded after the national organization and with the localization of Tampa Bay.
Yeah,
but yes.
And that makes sense. So when you came in, the organization was struggling a little bit, and you've often shared with your team you had three goals, correct, when you came in. What were those goals?
Yeah, they're behind me right now. I wrote them on the grease board when I came in. I thought there were three things that had to happen if the organization was going to be successful. The first was we needed to increase revenue. So I think when I got here, our annual revenue was somewhere, I think Kathy Wetzel tells me, somewhere around $2.8 million a year. A third of which came from agency fees.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
We used to charge agency sharing fees. So our fundraising was two-thirds.
Wow, okay.
Right? I threw out a goal that said, could we get to $10 million a year in revenue, which seemed insane at the time. I also thought if we could get $1 million in the bank, the organization would be a bit more stable. At the time, we had less than five figures in the bank. We had four figures in the bank.
Wow.
It was a little dodgy.
So did you know that when you walked in October?
I had read through some of the financial statements and I had a sense. I did not have the sense that it was...
Gotcha.
Situation was in. And then the last part was I wanted a paid for and owned facility because organizations like ours have to be able to control their destiny, have to have the ability foundationally to have the opportunity to live into your mission in the way that you want. We're rented space here.
Mm-hmm.
We have double the amount of rented space today we had when we got here. Not inexpensive, but it's also not space that's meant for our mission.
Right.
So I thought if we could do those three things, the food bank would never be in peril again. And so the very first goal I had was make sure the food bank never ended up in the position it was in when I got here again, that it had stability and capability that would endure no matter what.
What were some of, we talked about Feeding America Tampa Bay. What are some of the key things on the journey before we get into where we are now and the changes that you made that you thought were wins with the team that you had alongside you, right?
Yeah. When I first was approached about the job when I was still in Northern Florida, I am not a skilled researcher by any means, but I was able to Google. And so I Googled Feeding America Tampa Bay just to see what I could find. And there was very little information about Feeding America Tampa Bay. Now, there are a host of other terrific charities here in Tampa Bay that came up when you searched for food assistance, support, right? We were not anywhere close to one of those. And so when I interviewed with the board, they often ask you, understandably, are you comfortable raising money? Because one of the principal responsibilities of my job is to build resource, one of which is financial. And my answer to that was, well, no, I'm okay with doing it, even though by personal nature, I would never ask you for a favor for anything. It's my wife's great lament is I will not ask for help for anything. But for our mission, so I was more than comfortable saying, hey, we have something important we want to do here. Can you help us? But the issue for Feeding Tampa Bay is nobody knew who we were, why we were, how we were, where we were. And so the very first decision I made was we have to build, and shared that with the board when I was interviewing, we have to build brand recognition and awareness. In order for people to become interested in your mission, they have to know why you're doing it, for whom you're doing it, why it's important that you're doing it. So I tell this story before, but again, it's kind of the grace that comes along with that. We scrabbled together enough money to hold what we called Wine in the Warehouse, which was just a social event. Come in and have some wine, get to know us a little bit. I would do a little pitch. Now, you're talking screw top wine. Yeah, we used pallets for tables. I think we went,
Right?
Rustic, they call it. Yeah.
Right. We acted like it was our intention to be.
Right.
Right. It was our budget.
For you to experience the entire warehouse.
It's authentic.
Yeah. But one of the people that came to that event was a woman named Colleen Chappell.
Yeah.
And Colleen ran a very successful marketing, public relations, advertising, branding firm, multi-platform. And I asked her if I could come see her after this event, and she said, sure. And a listener may not know this. There is no more bubbly personality, can-do person in the world than Colleen Chappell. I don't think she would have ever said no to the visit, but so she agreed to see me, and I went over and went to see her a couple of days later, and I said, we have no money, but we have a good cause, an important cause that matters to our community, and we need to figure out how to tell that story to a greater community that knows about us today. Will you help with that? And she said, can you talk about that part about no money again?
What was that first part?
Yeah. And Colleen and her firm donated probably the equivalency of $5,000 a month in free support for the better part of 2 years.
Wow.
After that, we could start affording to pay her. But she helped us completely rebrand how we look, feel. what our value statement is, what our purpose is, how we articulate that to the community. So that was number one. Mm-hmm. How do you tell the community why you're here and what you're here for and why it's important that we're here, mm-hmm. right? Somebody listening to this today probably knows about us and say they don't know that there's a significant amount of time where nobody did.
Right.
The second thing that we did, which again I think befits our personality, is that we decided we would outwork everybody. Simple as that. So we all applied significant effort to making sure that we went out to every event there was. If somebody would let us speak, we would speak. Mm-hmm. I remember one of our big moments was we could finally afford a tablecloth for our where you're tabling at an event.
Yes.
We could afford a tablecloth, and I drew the straw at an event. It was over in Ybor, so I was the one tabling that night. And I'm sitting there with my little table, and I've got some, you know, we had like photocopied some information, right? Mm. We didn't have brochures. We photocopied color copies.
Here's an info sheet.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And this dude comes over after he's had his little plate of food, mm-hmm. and he sets it down on my table. Ooh. I'm like, hey, this isn't a place.
It's the trash can. No,
this is
no,
not
this
where
is
your snacks go, America. Man. I'm trying to make a living here. I'm trying to, you know, we're trying to tell a story here. He's like, oh, sorry. And he didn't want to know anything more about feeding Tampa Bay. He just kept walking.
Wow.
But we worked and we worked mm-hmm. and we worked. We increased the amount of food into the community dramatically mm-hmm. Because we understood, A, that our neighbors needed more help. But, B, we understood that if we worked hard, something good always comes from that. Mm-hmm. I think it's a lesson that my generation still holds on to. I often hope that other generations still hold on to that effort is rewarded. And so we didn't know from where or when it would come. But results did come. And so one is we had to figure out who we were and what we wanted to tell the world. Number two is we had to work hard. And the third thing that really changed the course of our organization was that it turns out we're really good at responding to crisis. And so there were several crises in a row, hurricanes and other things, that our organization stepped in fairly dramatic ways. That when, you know, as we would say, when others were leaving, we were staying. When folks were running, we were running out, we were running in. And so we worked at those moments. Again, our motive was to say the community needs us. But the outcome of that ended up being, oh, these are folks that are here and are connected and are willing to step in. Mm-hmm. The last part that I'll mention was one of the things that was on my mind when I came here was I wanted to create a very different organization culturally. That I wanted to build a place that was a place where everybody belonged, a place where folks could live into their ideas and responsibilities about what they wanted to be or what they wanted to do, that there was an equality and an equity, that there was, as a good friend of mine used to say, a wrench for every nut. That everybody had a place here. Mm-hmm. And so underneath all of that was a desire to bring humans into this work that shared those values, that could check an ego at the door and say, hey, I want to do this work with you, but I want to do this work for others.
Right.
And we attracted a lot of those folks along the way. Many of them are still here with us today. Mm-hmm. But we were fortunate in that we felt really strongly that we didn't care as much about your particular job experience. We cared much more about your life experience and your human experience and your willingness and desire to step into a cause. We tell everybody that comes to work here, this isn't about you.
Right.
This is about those we serve.
Right.
And so that's hard to do sometimes. It's hard to accept sometimes. And so those are probably the things that I would say were most notable and made us successful.
I think what's notable, too, you talk about Colleen Chappell, which she has a podcast episode if anyone wants to learn about her. Mm-hmm. You can go back in the archive.
Incredible
and
human.
Check
incredible human.
She's amazing.
Her personal story alone
yes,
is staggering.
Yes, she is just, like you said, an incredible human being and just so kind, but so brilliant, her yes. and her team. Mm-hmm. I had first, when I came about into hunger relief 7-8 years ago, they started a campaign because folks really thought the only person that was hungry was right. someone that was homeless.
Yes.
And together, you guys came out with an entire and enormously beautiful and successful campaign explaining that.
Called Don't Label Hunger.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, it was. And I remember there were several stories about that, and two in particular, which still stick with me today. We had four or five people we told their personal stories of, and they were neighbors that used our services. The first one was a woman named Carol. And Carol would self-describe as probably not petite, not overweight, but right. stockier in her build and size. And I remember getting Facebook posts that asked why she shouldn't just stop eating more.
Mm. Wow.
Why wouldn't she care more about her personal appearance? And maybe if she ate less food, she would be in less danger.
Mm. Right.
The other one I remember is about a young man that was going to college, putting himself through college at night and taking care of his grandparents. He was a young man of color with an unusual name.
Mm-hmm.
And we got posts that said, why don't you go back to the country you came from?
Wow.
Right. Now, I'm sharing these not because I want this to feel negative, but you talked about changing perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
That's how hard we have to work. Because what people didn't know was Carol had had a workplace injury and she was unable to work anymore and she was taking care of a special needs child.
Right.
They were on a one income for her husband that worked at a pretty large company, but they couldn't make it because of her son's special needs. The young student eventually graduated with a 4-year degree, taking care of his grandfather the entire way through his college career mm-hmm. because no one else in his family could or would. And I see those as stories. We all see those as stories of incredible bravery and capability. Mm-hmm. And Don't Label Hunger was about trying to break through those labels to say, think differently about right. who this is.
Right. Ask the questions. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a struggle. I remember starting at Trinity Cafe. That was a boots on the ground mm-hmm. learning that inevitably made me a better person, mm-hmm. helped teach me more.
I don't think you can do this work. When I started into the nonprofit world, there was a priest that was influential in my life, and I was talking to him about some of this, and at one point he said, you know, you're not more important than the banker or the guy that cuts the lawn. You're just right. a person at, right? And I've tried to hold that dear, because I think that is in our world, people, you tell them you work for a nonprofit, you get a whole lot of, aren't you a good person?
right.
Aren't you, right?
Well, that's nice.
Yeah. We're so glad you do this work. Yeah. And I appreciate the sentiment, but I think what we have to understand is that this work doesn't make us better humans, but it certainly does give us more perspective.
Yes.
Right. You understand the concept of therefore, but for the grace of God, go I.
Mm-hmm.
That you are, all of us are, and you mentioned some of your circumstances. I shared some of mine where I didn't have resources in my life.
Yeah.
And you understand what that is like mm-hmm. To not feed yourself or to make decisions you have to make. And so I think if nothing else, the work that we do gives us all a perspective. Interestingly, as we all navigated the pandemic, what did everybody get? Perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because people had a job yesterday and thought they had a pathway that they had identified, that mm-hmm. they were comfortable with, that could be maintained, whether it was their car payment or their boat payment or their rent right. payment or whatever it was.
Or buying food.
Yeah.
Suddenly,
yeah. Right.
I have nothing.
Yes.
And it was interesting for us that did this work to go through that with people that mm-hmm. suddenly understood, oh, I am one of those people right. that is X event away from needing help.
Right. Absolutely. And I you talk about being a nonprofit and our hearts. I actually thought 20 years ago I was retiring to nonprofit. And I don't think I've grown, of course, more as an individual as if I would have stayed where I was. But I've worked, I think, harder, but more joyfully because of the outcome, like working for a purpose than I ever imagined I'd be able to do. But when you said that, made that comment, I was like, yeah, I was going to retire into nonprofit.
Right.
And, yeah. Take it easy.
Right.
Exactly.
Nope.
Yeah. What?
Nope.
Not even. But the thing is your soul is
yes.
so full
yes. yeah.
that the hours don't matter. And, you know, you mentioned the pandemic. I mean, I think 3 months, did any of us have a day off because of these folks that we're experiencing challenges for the first time?
I think that I think that there's a unique person that can work in this environment mm-hmm. and withstand the psychic pressure while also maintaining yeah. the work responsibilities. You know, all of us have a story of people that we came across in this work that reminds us and that, you know, that we come back to. And I remember during the pandemic in particular, I've joked about this before, but I was invariably given traffic duty. Mm-hmm. And so as we had thousands of cars lining up at one of our mass distributions, I was once again assigned to traffic. but we would literally have 2,000 or 3,000 cars waiting to get mm-hmm. food. And they would have been waiting there since 2 or 3 in the morning, and the distribution would start at 8 a.m. And so it was probably about 7:15 or 7:20, and I was walking back to my station, and I maybe went back 50 cars. Now, remember, there are thousands of cars yeah. there. We are going to give away food for 4 or 5 hours, car after car after mm-hmm. car. We have tractor-trailer loads of food, right? Mm-hmm. And I walked past this woman who rolled down her window because, again, on traffic duty, it was raining. Mm. And
perfect.
Perfect.
We have tons of pictures. I'm not under the tent.
I'm out in the right. She rolled down her windows, and she said in her best English, can you help me? And I said, sure. What can I do for you? And she said, am I going to get food today? Mm. Now, I have the perspective of there are thousands of yeah. cars there. And this is probably the 3rd or 4th week we're doing this in a row. And I know how much food we've brought over from the warehouse. But I'm still struck by the look on her face and the fear that she had that she would not be able to feed her children. That, I think, for everybody that does this work, mm-hmm. sits on you as both an obligation as well as a responsibility. And I think that's the part that all of us, it's really the harder part of the job. Physical effort's one thing, but understanding that the obligation to someone who is in the worst moment of their lives, as this mother was, mm-hmm. scared to death, she would not be able to feed her children that day. Those are the things that I think we wouldn't, you know, the word heroic is used often. I don't think our heroism is around our work. I think our heroism is around our ability to enter into that relationship in that moment with folks that need us mm-hmm. and understand that we can do something about it and should do something about it.
You know, we jumped into the pandemic, but I wanted to talk about kind of the journey and how, again, living through grace, things happen that help feed the success further down the road. So there was a merger with Trinity Cafe, right? And I don't know how long it was, because I worked there. I don't know how long it was in the works, and I know you've been friends with Jeff Derry for a long time, but it seems to me that merger was so timely because then when the pandemic hit, that lent into doing yeah. so many additional things than food distribution.
Yeah, I think you realize in hindsight what you think is for some purpose ends up being for mm-hmm. another different, maybe better purpose. One of the things we knew from talking to our neighbors enough, and we actually did studies around this with USF, was that many of our neighbors needed more prepared meals.
Yeah.
We largely gave out groceries, but our neighbors were saying to us, hey, I'm a senior and I can't necessarily cook. Or, hey, I'm a mom that is struggling to budget time. And while I appreciate the bag of groceries, I can't always get home and prepare meals for my kids. It's one of the reasons why I stop at a fast food place. This had been on our minds for several years. Jeff and I were good friends, as mm-hmm. I mentioned, and we're having conversations. We were pretty close partners with Trinity, provided them with a lot of their food. But we started to have the conversation to say, is there a better way for us to work together more thoughtfully? And what does that look like, and how could we do that? Why would it matter? And what could we do to bring value to Trinity's world? What could Trinity do to bring value to our world? And we hit on two probably really important things, is Trinity would allow us to bring meals to the community. They had kitchens, they served meals. What we could do is expand Trinity's and build them at a much greater pace.
Yes.
And so we started talking about that. Jeff and I talked about it off and on for a couple of years. You know, we'd return to it. We'd have coffee every Friday morning. And we talk about it from time to time and just discuss what it might or might not look like. And so it ended up being a really great marriage, ultimately because organizationally we had the same values. Jeff introduced a concept to us that remains really important in our work today, which is the concept of dignity. Mm-hmm. Now, I would have told you that we operated in a dignified fashion, but Jeff helped us take that to a whole different level of understanding. As he would have shared, Trinity Cafe was 51% dignity, 49% food. Mm-hmm. And it allowed us to adopt that across the whole of our organization. As you mentioned, had we not had those cafes during the pandemic, we would not have been able to produce meals for homebound seniors who couldn't go to grocery stores and a wide variety of other folks who needed prepared meals. It also led us to, in the facility we're building today, to totally rethink how we're going to be in the prepared foods business because, again, for the neighbors we serve, this is a significant part of their world.
So you mentioned disaster response, which is part of that, but I want to jump ahead to, 5 years ago, mm-hmm. 4 or 5 years ago, where we imagined a hunger-free Tampa Bay. Tell us, it's all leading to the path of our exciting news this month, but tell us a little bit about Imagine.
So Imagine is the word you would expect it to be, but it really was born out of a moment where one of our colleagues at Chapel Roberts, Katie, was sharing that on her way over to a meeting where we were talking about how we might introduce our ideas to the community, that she had been listening to Hey Jude over and over again, which is also the name of her son. And past that, she listened to the song Imagine, which was a song that she had shared with her father. Mm-hmm. And she shared this just as a conversation, not as a concept. And I think it was Colleen who turned around and said, that's it.
Mm. That's the one. Imagine.
Let's imagine a different future for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so that allowed us to start. We knew the story we wanted to tell. The idea of a hunger-free Tampa Bay, imagining different possibilities and outcomes, changing the community in a meaningful way. The only way we could do that was with a new facility. As I mentioned earlier, the facility we have, we outgrew that 5 years ago and have made by hook or by crook our way through not having a proper facility. But the facility not only allowed us to solve the problems that we have, that's not why you build a new facility. It helps with that. But you build a new facility because you imagine a much different outcome, a much different community, a much different opportunity that it affords you. And so imagine was the perfect word for us to use because we were stepping well beyond our boundaries. Mm-hmm. We were moving away from just being a food bank into a community resource. We were stepping out significantly in the way we went about the design and build of the new facility to say, we want to do much more. We can do much more and we will do much more. And so Imagine ended up being the perfect word to describe what we wanted to do.
In that time, in our time of imagining that we have all been through, what were some of the key things that we learned that we're going to implement in the future?
Boy, that's a good question, one that has many parts to it. I think I would start with this. We have still yet to meet anybody that we provide food to that has said to us, I am food insecure. Mm-hmm. Not one of them. No one comes up to us and says, hey, I'm food insecure. Mm-hmm. Folks come up to us and say, I'm in a bad spot. Yeah, I got a lot going on and I can't feed my family mm-hmm. or myself. What we know is that there are a variety of challenges that families are struggling with. So that may be the cost of rent or transportation. That may be a medical bill. That may be a crisis of some other kind. But food is the thing that will drive people into our care. Mm-hmm. And more people will access our care than any other charity, not because we're better, but because we're bigger. More people will seek food assistance. And our question really became, what do we do with that moment? What is our obligation to that moment? Mm-hmm. For many years, we thought our obligation was just simply to provide food. And we began to see that as short-sighted and not likely to solve anyone's problem, though a very humane and important intervention. Right? When a human being needs food, it has to be there for them.
Right.
But we started to say, what more can we do with this? What is our opportunity and obligation? Now, in our world, again, I'm going to assume that people listen to something like this are familiar with social services. In our world, we have a conversation called mission creep, which is what board members will offer up the moment you say you want to do other stuff. And we have a great board. But the only people that never talk about mission creep? Neighbors.
Right.
Every other successful business that we know of figures out a way to consolidate services and provide more to the customer when they walk in. Every single, think about the places you shop and you go to, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't know. Maybe you go to the same place that does your hair, your nails, you're right. They are full service.
Yes.
Right. You might go to the same electronics company that not only has this particular, right, because that's important to you. Right. Mm-hmm. You go to places where they understand how they can offer you a variety of services, make your life more convenient, give you a better, more successful outcome that's important to you, whether that's purchasing items or having certain services completed. Right. All of those things are important to us. Well, guess where that never happens? It's for neighbors in need.
Right.
And our vision was we could do more with that. We could create better, more successful outcomes if we co-located, co-created what we would call a community center. The idea where more folks can come together in unison of service, obligation, responsibility to make sure that the outcomes for the folks that come into our care are better,
right,
longer lasting, more enduring, more successful. We can't offer everything to everybody. That's not what we want to be or want to do. But we would think of the new facility and our vision of it is that it offers us a foundation where everybody can be invited in to do those things. So we'll have other organizations present with us that offer services and resources that we don't offer. To our neighbor in need, when they walk in the door, we simply want to say one thing to them. How can we help you?
Right.
Period.
Well, and you know, because we live in this world, what these poor folks that are struggling with, and then they just get passed on and passed on and passed on. And for me, I can't wait to see the moment that a struggling mom comes in for food, and then you can see healthcare, mental health, housing, whatever the things are that are the targets.
Right.
Bringing her peace for a moment, because I will never forget a woman who responded to me. I said, "How do you feel?" And she goes, "I'm at peace."
Mm. Yes. Boy, so. There's probably no greater gift you can give another human being than peace of mind. You know, I'm reminded of a story of one of our colleagues, Sarah, who, a little differently, but it illustrates what we want to accomplish. Sarah was a mom with her child at one of our pantries inside of a school. She went to pick up her child. She went to the food pantry on campus, saw a brochure for our job training program, went through our job training program, Fresh Force, graduated very successfully, and has been employed with us for probably 4 years.
Yes.
That's what we think success looks like. Yeah. The more resources we bring together and around a person, she was able to navigate all of those because they all came under our roof.
Right.
The more we offer that, we think the outcomes for neighbors that seek services will be better.
Right. And the beautiful thing about Sarah is she now runs the pantry that she used to actually attend.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And many, many more
helping
folks out.
Yes.
So we're moving in. Tell us your thoughts.
You know, I said this earlier. I've been asked this question about 6,927 times.
This week or this month?
Right. And graciously
well, in the past 18 months.
I think people are very interested in our story. They're very interested in the work that we're doing. You know, I'm built to perform tasks and get things done. I'm not built much to reflect on. I'm more consumed with what we need to do next.
I was just going to say, stop that. I'm getting it.
Yeah.
So first three goals have been met in 11 years' time.
Yeah. And so
is the next goal? Let's rephrase.
So we're not going to reveal that on this podcast, but we'll talk about that in a future one. But there are some things that are on my mind that I think we want to accomplish, because I think it's really important to the listener and everybody that comes into our care. The building is not a terminus. It's a starting point.
Yes.
And I think we need to understand that it's only going to be as successful a facility as we make it. And so what's on my mind most is how do we take this wonderful asset that the community has helped us build, that folks have helped us design and understand and create, how do we take this asset and help it create its greatest, live into its greatest capacity and capability? More than anything else, that's probably what's on my mind, Shannon, as I think about that. Mm-hmm. The building is built.
Yep.
The design is done. There's lots we'll learn and figure out as we go along. But the question that really sticks to me is, okay, you know, we jokingly say, you know, it's like the dog that caught the car. Well, what do you do now?
Right.
I'm much more interested in what do we do with this? How do we live into its fullest potential? What does that look like? How do we use it to leverage social change?
Mm-hmm.
We built a facility of this size, magnitude, and scope because we thought it could act as a catalyst to change a whole lot more than just mm-hmm. our world. I think that's one of the things that's on my mind a lot in terms of what am I thinking and how do I feel is how does this leverage and catalyze a community so that we are able to do more and have more successful outcomes.
Well, moving day is around the corner.
It is around the corner.
We're really excited that Thomas is with us today, but we're kind of launching kind of another year of Stick a Fork in It, and you're going to be bringing some fun friends here and there.
Yeah, I'd rather be on the other side of the microphone, that's for sure.
Yeah. In the place you're most comfortable.
Huh? Can't hear you well on the other side.
So you guys are going to get to meet some of Thomas's great friends that help us in our work, and he'll join the team every once in a while when he can bring somebody great along. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Congratulations.
Yeah, to all of us.
And 42 years, right? Feeding Tampa Bay has been in mm-hmm. existence.
Yeah, in one name or another.
Pick which one.
Right.
And the past 11 have been quite the successful ride.
Yeah, I remember I wanted to open up the. I was hoping we could open the facility at our 40th year, but it just didn't quite work out that way.
That's okay. 42 will be just fine.
Yeah. Just fine.
Thank you, Thomas. We'll see you on opening day.
You can learn more about Feeding Tampa Bay and how to join the movement at feedingtampabay.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and TikTok at Feeding Tampa Bay.